If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
As I'm sure you already know, this podcast is produced by the team behind BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. And if you haven't had a chance to get hold of our magazine recently, we'd like to offer you the chance to get a copy of our next issue absolutely free. Please text the word HISTORY to 78070 to request your free magazine today. One of our team will be in touch to organise delivery direct to your door. This offer is available for a limited time only and only available for UK residents. So please don't miss out. Text HISTORY to 78070 to get your free copy today. Just a quick note, texts are normally charged at your standard network rate. Please check with your provider for further details. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Statues have been in the news around the world, but statues of medieval figures haven't featured prominently in the debates. Why not? Well, our content director, Dr. Dave Musgrove, called Dr. Simon John of Swansea University to discuss this question and to talk specifically about the equestrian statue of Richard the Lionheart, which stands outside the Palace of Westminster in London.
Today I'm talking to Dr. Simon John, Senior Lecturer in Medieval History at the University of Swansea and an expert on the socio-cultural impact of the Crusades in Latin Christendom. He's currently engaged in a project entitled Contested Past, Public Monuments and Historical Culture in Western Europe, 1815 to 1930, which is funded by the British Academy and the Leverhulme Trust. And that is exploring the political uses of monuments and statues in 19th century European states. So you might have heard there's been a bit of a debate recently over the rights and wrongs of statues around the world. Famously, statues of 18th century slave traders like Edward Colston have been deplatformed for their role in the slave trade. There's conversations going on about Confederate general statues in the US, and also conversations have commenced about whether figures from earlier in history, such as Sir Francis Drake, ought to be taken down for their involvement in the developing slave trade in the 16th century. But there has not been much discussion of taking this process earlier back in time. Medieval statues have been largely ignored thus far. So I'm going to chat to Simon about this now. He has two hats here, as I said, one as a medievalist and one as a researcher of statues. So an ideal person to talk to about where statues of medieval figures sit or stand in this debate. And we're going to frame it around a conversation about King Richard I and a statue that commemorates his reign. So Simon, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here, great.
Okay, so firstly, can you tell us about this statue of Richard I? Where is it? What is it? And how did it get to where it is?
Sure. So the statue, as it stands today, is in Old Palace Yard, which is one of the kind of spaces outside the Palace of Westminster, better known as the Houses of Parliament. Essentially, it's not far from the entrance to the House of Lords. It was the creation of a sculptor who was born in Italy but raised in France by the name of Carlo Marochetti. And he was an artist who was resident in France up to the revolutions of 1848. And the repercussions of that revolution forced him to move to London. And a few years later, he created the first version of the statue in order for it to be displayed at the Great Exhibition in London in 1851. So it was well received, the sculpture at the exhibition. And in the years afterwards, throughout the 1850s, there was a campaign widely supported by prominent politicians. The most prominent supporters were Victoria and Albert themselves, to sponsor the creation of a permanent version of this sculpture of Richard. And it's this that was eventually cast in bronze, installed in Old Palace Yard in 1860.
And it's a pretty big statue, isn't it?
It very much so. So from the base of the pedestal, the granite pedestal, to the very kind of uppermost point, which is the sword, the tip of the sword that Richard holds aloft, it's about 9 metres in total. So a pretty colossal example of equestrian statuary.
And is it actually visible to the public? Can you see it, or do you have to be going into the domain of the House of Commons?
You can see it as you walk in the road that kind of runs alongside the palace, but you can't get close to it by a reason that the kind of security fences that have been installed outside Parliament basically cordon the whole precinct, Westminster precinct, off. So you can see it from a distance. If you've got a camera that has a good zoom, you can get a better view. But I think it's a good 20, 30 metres is the closest you can get to it today.
Okay, so it's a Victorian statue of a medieval king. And a lot of this, the conversation that's been going on around the world is about Victorian statues. Is the 19th century, the Victorian period in Britain, is that the sort of the apogee of statuary commemorations? And is it actually, more specifically, just the later 19th century that we get this massive interest in statues? Why? And is it unique to Britain, or is it a broader concept?
I would say very much this is the age of statue building. Academics who've worked on the 19th century speak of an age of statuomania, a sort of craze for the creation of new statues. It does start early in the sort of first half of the 19th century, but really kind of picks up in the second half. So the number of statues being created does kind of increase in the latter part. So this is the age of nationalism, states kind of pursuing state building projects, looking to forge new brands of national identity in this age of nationalism. And in this context, kind of cultural fields, art, literature, and so on, are very much kind of central to what these states are doing. And as part of that, we see statues springing up in capital cities throughout the continent. So yes, it takes place in Britain, but it's a continental-wide thing throughout Europe as well. There are kind of specifics. There are kind of local peculiarities in particular nations, but the wider trend, I would say, is consistently kind of prominent throughout the continent across the 19th century.
Okay. Now, a lot of the statues they put up were, for probably obvious reasons, were heroes of the age, the colonial figures, the military figures of that period. But there are some earlier ones, and Richard I, a medieval statue. But are there many statues of medieval figures that were put up in this period, or is this a bit of an outlier?
No, very much so. There's as part of this trend of statuomania, there's a real fashion, a real interest in creating monuments to medieval figures, and that's continental wide too. So Charlemagne, for example, we see statues of him created in both France and Belgium. Joan of Arc is commemorated by numerous statues in France, and figures like Frederick Barbarossa have statues created in their honour in the German-speaking lands. So we can connect this on one hand to a far wider 19th century interest in the Middle Ages, which kind of manifests itself in other ways. So in Britain, for example, we get the novels of Walter Scott, the paintings of the Pre-Raphaelites. And what we're seeing is a society that's kind of reaching toward the Middle Ages for a very particular reason. The 19th century, great societal upheavals caused by industrialization. For many, this brings about kind of spiritual anxieties. And in this context, the Middle Ages is kind of idealized as a simpler, more pious age, as a kind of soothing antidote to the societal changes that industrialization is bringing around.
You've touched on this just in your last answer, but I mean, many commentators have pointed out that the statues that we're talking about, the ones which are being discussed as whether they should be still standing or not, they tell us more about 19th century values or Victorian values specifically, if we're talking about Britain, than anything else. Is that a fair assessment? It's really about the people who put them up rather than the people they commemorate.
Yeah, totally. So when we look at certain examples of statues, we can see in some contexts that their creators did make very clear attempts to use certain medieval sources or medieval traditions around the particular figure as inspiration. But for the most part, what these 19th century statues tell us about, even if they're of Charlemagne or Joan of Arc or whichever other medieval figure, what they tell us about is 19th century values and ideas. So the statue, our statue of Richard in London, very much illustrates this quite nicely, I'd say. So when we think about contemporary responses to this statue, people who observed it or visited it at the Great Exhibition or in its permanent version from 1860 believed that it illustrated a number of ideas that were very important to society at the time. So these would be things like devotion to Christianity, the moral principles of chivalry, the importance, the strength of monarchical authority. So these were all things that mattered very greatly to, in Britain at least, Victorian society. And we can take one of these a bit and look at it in a bit more detail, perhaps. So if we think about the religious connotations of the Richard statue in London, what we're talking about is a statue created in an age that scholars sometimes refer to as an age of what's known as muscular Christianity. The idea sort of bound up with ideas of imperialism and so on, that upholding manliness and the possession of physical strength was part of the duty of all good Christian men. And Richard, our statue in London, very much embodies this quite literally. So contemporaries comment on the fact that, you know, the figure of Richard has muscles that sort of bulge under his chainmail. It's very much kind of articulating this idea. And above all, the statue is presented in the 19th century, as Richard was himself more generally, as an icon of Englishness. And that's a presentation that doesn't really map on all that well to the real 12th century figure at all.
Okay, so that handily links us into talking about the real 12th century figure. Firstly, I suppose we should just, is the statue at all a likeness of the man? Do we know much about what he would have looked like and how far is this statue representative of that?
So I think there's a funerary monument on his tomb in Fontevraud, if I remember correctly, but that was created some years after his death. I think there might have been some discussion that Marochetti might have consulted that likeness when he was creating his statue. But even if he did, it wouldn't necessarily bring us closer to what Richard actually looked like before his death anyway.
Okay, right. But we need to know who Richard was. We need to know the sort of the key points of his life and reign. So would you be able to just briefly sketch out the main things we need to know about?
Of course. So this was a man who was born in Oxford in 1157. And he was the third son of the incumbent King of England, ruler of the Angevin Empire, Henry II. And this was an empire that encompassed about half of what we would today call France. So he wasn't just King of England. He had authority over this great continental empire as well. So Richard spent his early years in England. But then from 1172, he's active almost exclusively on the continent, because in 1172, his father appoints him Duke of Aquitaine. So from this point onwards, and basically for the rest of his life, the most dominant feature of Richard's life is warfare. He spends most of the rest of his life from this point on campaign. Fortunately for Richard, his two elder brothers both died before him and their father. So that meant that when Henry II died in 1189, it was Richard who was the successor. So Richard succeeds to be King of England and ruler of the Angevin lands. Even before his inauguration as King of England, though, in 1189, Richard had been planning to go on crusade in response to the loss of Jerusalem to the forces of Saladin in 1187. So between 1190 and 1192, Richard was away from the West, participating in what historians call the Third Crusade. And it was this, above all, that kind of propels him towards legendary status, because it was the Third Crusade that brought him into conflict with the legendary figure of Saladin. So the Third Crusade ends. The Christian forces and Richard don't recover Jerusalem, but what they do is they kind of shore up the Christian presence in the Holy Land in the Near East, making a bridgehead that kind of 13th century successors would use to try and recover Jerusalem. Richard leaves the Holy Land in 1192, but on the way home through Austria, he's captured by an enemy. And for the next year and a bit, he's held captive by the Emperor Henry VI. And he's moved through various locations in Germany while his subjects back in his lands are raising the necessary ransom. That's finally raised. 1194, Richard is released. He comes back to his lands, briefly to England, but most of the rest of his life from 1194, when he's released, he's spent on campaign in his continental lands. He's trying to restore his position that he'd had before he left. Basically, while he was away, his younger brother John of Magna Carta fame had been in cahoots with Richard's enemy, Philip II, King of France, undermined Richard's position in his lands. It's Richard's task when he's back to try and restore his authority in these lands. So it's in the context of this effort to recover his position, he's taking part in a siege in 1199 in his old Duchy of Aquitaine. Unfortunately for him, he's struck by a crossbow and the wound turns gangrenous. And this takes place in 1199. And a week or so later, he dies. That's his life, so to speak.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you. That's a very concise summary of the man's life. Now, one way to try and assess historical figures is to consider how they were viewed in the context of their own time. So you've outlined there he was clearly a warlike figure and martial skill, military prowess was something that I think was looked on favourably at the time, certainly in the upper echelons of society. I think he was a courageous man, or at least he was seen to be courageous, but he was also perhaps seen to be avaricious, or at least demanding in terms of the money that he required for his military endeavours, and perhaps he was seen as more cruel than other similar military figures. So, are those things that play into it, and how else was he seen in his time?
Indeed, so he is a figure that even in his own lifetime evokes very strong reactions. Indeed, both positive and negative. So exactly as you say, there are contemporaries, including his critics, who really emphasize his bravery, his abilities as a leader, his qualities as a fighter himself, as a man of war. These are such that even in his own lifetime, his legend starts to develop. So he's known as the Lionheart while he's still alive. This legend, the kind of kernel of it, comes into existence while he still lives. And then in the centuries after his death, kind of evolves and develops. There is a sense among some contemporaries that sometimes he waged war in a way that kind of went beyond normal levels. So as part of his efforts in Aquitaine, for example, in the 1170s, some of his opponents see him as acting in an overly brutal, cruel way. Some critics write that he spends much of his time kind of chasing around the wives and daughters of his subjects. So partly behavior that's going to endear him to his kind of political subjects. And in terms of the kind of financial issues you've touched on, very much so, contemporaries complain time and time again the financial demands he's placing on his subjects. First, to raise money to go on crusade, and then to raise funds to pay for the ransom that will see him released from the captivity of Henry VI of Germany. So these are criticisms that we do see time and time again.
And am I right in thinking that he did a pretty good job himself of sort of writing himself up and making sure that that people were aware of his successes?
I'd say so. So if we were to kind of think about this in modern terms, I think we're talking about an individual who kind of understood the value of good PR. He was someone who was kind of aware of the importance of crafting a particular image. So he's someone who, when he departed on crusade, took an artifact, a sword that was regarded to be Excalibur, with him. He's someone who was happy to engage with his enemies via the kind of, we call it the kind of column sheets of his day, through kind of political songs. kind of aristocratic poems that he has composed in criticism of particular enemies and so on. So I think he's very much conscious that there are mechanisms for him to craft a particular image of himself for the benefit of his contemporaries.
Now, thinking about how we view Richard today, obviously a lot of this this shiny example of kingship type stuff has come down to us. It's been challenged, and a lot of people have critiqued that. But there's still some sort of glow or aura that that surrounds him for a lot of people, which is an interesting thing when you think about his role in the Crusades and how the Crusades should be seen perhaps today. Obviously, clearly very problematic for us to take a view on that and to understand it. So how do you think his role in the Crusades and his particular activities perhaps at in terms of what he did to some Muslim hostages, how should that sort of nuance our understanding of how we should see this?
So yeah, this stems back to a particular incident that took place on the Third Crusade. So the main kind of military objective of the Third Crusade is the Siege of Acre. So a siege is kind of going on for years, even before Richard and the other Third Crusaders arrive. So Richard arrives in June 1191. And he and the fellow Christians taking part in the siege capture the city in July 1191. In the process of taking the city, they capture several thousand hostages. Some reports say around 3,000 Muslim hostages. And in the period afterwards, these hostages basically become bargaining chips in this negotiation between Richard and his fellow crusading leaders and Saladin. So the outcome was that even though an agreement seemed to have been reached with Saladin, it wasn't actually acted upon. Richard sees that Saladin's deadline to fulfill certain promises had expired. So on the 20th of August, he orders these hostages to be marched out of the city, kind of placed in front of the Muslim camp and executed to a man. Again, this comes down to the question of perspective. Richard himself, in a letter he wrote in October 1191 and sent home, he said this was quite proper. Saladin had defaulted on his agreement, therefore it was completely within my rights and the right of all of us crusaders to order the deaths of these hostages. What's crucial, though, is I think, as we saw with some of Richard's activities in Aquitaine earlier in his career, there were at least some contemporaries who believed that this was beyond the pale. This exceeded normal standards. On the one hand, we have Islamic chroniclers, so biographers of Saladin, who, you know, we might expect see this as a barbarous, treacherous act. But there are Christian writers who some kind of outright decry it. Others are very anxious to kind of shift blame away from Richard, saying that this wasn't Richard's fault, it was Saladin's fault for failing to follow through on the agreement. In terms of where this fits in kind of collective understanding of and memorialization of Richard today, it's very hard to say. I would say almost for the most part, this fade, this kind of event is almost kind of completely overlooked when we think about Richard and what comes to the fore. What, you know, is embodied in this statue at Westminster is the kind of glorious, heroic, moralistic, chivalrous figure. So there's almost a kind of collective amnesia to put to one side the bits that don't fit that narrative and instead focus on the aspects, the qualities that kind of match up to it.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Richard spends the most of his political career in France. Famously, of his 10 years as King of England, he spent about 6 months in England. So by no means is he kind of making great contributions to, you know, England's administrative constitutional development.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
So there's that specific incident, which in the eyes of some contemporary commentators was going beyond the pale of appropriate action. But in terms of the wider picture of the Crusades, Richard the Lionheart embraced the Crusades. He appears to have, you know, been very enthusiastic to do it, and you know, he's had alacrity to get on Crusade as soon as he was able. And the Crusades generally are you know, clearly that's something that in our modern situation we have to treat you know, very carefully. And I suppose one of the most simplistic reading of the Crusades is that it's a religious conflict and Christian warriors going to win back the Holy Land. But there is a reading which I hope I'm not misquoting it, but Professor Geraldine Heng, who's written a lot on racism in the medieval world, I think is suggesting that actually we should see the Crusades as a racist endeavor, and that takes us into a whole different paradigm, particularly when we're talking about the statues, the other statues we've been discussing, which a lot of the discussions there are based on racism and questions of racism and slavery. So give me a view on that as to where we should how we should understand that.
Okay, so I think you're exactly right to kind of flag up this very important work by Professor Heng. I regard this, you know, as really important work, a really important contribution to, you know, a subject that needs to be treated very carefully. So for me, one of the reasons why I think Geraldine Heng's work is so important is because, to a large degree, it encourages us to turn the focus not necessarily directly onto what people did or did think in the Middle Ages. That's part of it. But she asks us to kind of turn the focus on how modern historians have kind of gone about approaching this topic as well. So an argument that she makes that I actually, you know, when I reflect on what I see in medieval sources and so on, an argument that I find very convincing is that a form of racism did exist in the Middle Ages, but that modern historians, modern scholars writing about the Middle Ages have been very unwilling to refer to it in those terms. So she says that, you know, historians have used euphemisms essentially like pre-modern chauvinism, xenophobia, to describe what actually we should call racism. So it's clear from, you know, the start of, you know, human history, humans have noted differences between different groups, and in some contexts, those differences have given grounds for discrimination in particular contexts. So what Professor Heng points out is that while in the Middle Ages the kind of key grounds for discrimination were indeed religion and religious difference, in some contexts, those differences included kind of physical differences as well. So she calls it a kind of a biopolitical aspect to differentiation. So in other words, particularly hated groups were ascribed particular physical characteristics as part of the process of discriminating against them. So yeah, in brief, I think we should speak of racism in the Middle Ages. Racial difference was indeed construed in a way that doesn't necessarily map directly onto how it's construed today. But what Professor Heng would say is that if we use a different word, if we use a word or a term other than racism, arguably what we're doing is an injustice both to the period, to the Middle Ages, and our own conversation about the relevance of that period to our own modern day discussions on race.
And I suppose reading her book, she goes into a lot of detail about anti-Semitic activities and a general sense of anti-Semitism across the medieval period. And I suppose then that would make us wonder about statues of the likes of Henry III or Edward I, whose actions were avowedly anti-Semitic. I mean, Edward I expelled the Jews from England in 1290, for instance. So that puts us into a whole different sphere of conversation, I suppose.
Very much so, but one that still deserves the same level of attention and care, I would say. So historians over the years, over the centuries, have kind of talked about English history as a kind of at the rise of the English state and the march towards bureaucracy and a kind of administrative structure and so on. And what happens in the 13th century with the increasing discrimination and expulsion of the Jews from England in 1190 doesn't really figure in that kind of wider picture of England's triumphal administrative development. But if we're going to have a kind of wider cultural reckoning, and think about the suitability of statues from the 19th century or whenever today, figures who have been involved in anti-Semitic acts, either ordering them or kind of carrying them out, I would say very much they should be part of this conversation about whether they still merit their place in our cities, our towns today.
Now, going back a bit, though, in terms of going back to the Richard statue, that was set up in the Victorian period in 1860. So, obviously, in a completely different sphere of understanding and I guess moral compass. But if I read things rightly and according to the entry in the Oxford Dictionary of Natural Biography by Professor John Gillingham, Richard wasn't exactly flavour of the month, at least in academic circles in that period. He was seen as this sort of the king who left his English realm and basically tried to get as much money out of the people as he could. So why then would he have been a figure suitable for commemoration at that stage?
Well, you're exactly right. Just as Richard had supporters and critics in the 12th century, so too the same kind of thing we see in the 19th century. So on the one hand, through things like the novels of Walter Scott, Richard is very much held up as a kind of Victorian hero. On the other hand, we get a large number of commentators, including academic scholars of the period, who, as you say, kind of take a very different view of Richard and his kind of contribution to English history. So this is the age, again, where historians, or a number of them, are interested in kind of England's constitutional development. So people like Bishop William Stubbs, who edited important sources and wrote important histories of English history, regard Richard as a very bad king, exactly the same, because he neglected England. And because he kind of taxed England to the seams in order to raise money for his adventures. So he's seen as kind of neglecting England so that he can go off on adventure, on crusade. The key point is that this, again, tells us more about 19th century expectations than the 12th century. Observers in the 12th century weren't criticizing Richard for going on crusade. They were praising him for it. This was seen to be part of the duty of a Christian ruler at that point. So you're exactly right. I mean, the display of Marichetti's statue at the Great Exhibition in 1851 kind of makes waves. This campaign takes shape for the permanent version for the Houses of Parliament, as we discussed, kind of successfully results in the creation of that in 1860. But in that period, in the 1850s, there's considerable opposition to the idea of installing a statue of Richard in that place. And some of the opponents are kind of channeling the spirit of Bishop Stubbs, saying he was a bad king, he was bad for England, he neglected his kingdom. And I guess the real explanation for why actually the campaign was successful and why the statue was created is probably less to do with particular perceptions of Richard among people like Stubbs, people who shared his view, than with the fact that Marochetti, he knew the right people. So what happened is key members of the political establishment, all the way up to Victoria and Albert herself, are a supporter of his, and they contribute kind of backing and money to finance the project for the bronze version. And it's that ultimately kind of results in the permanent version being created. So that says something about, you know, Victorian society to us as well.
And yet he was no a defender of Parliament or parliamentary values, wasn't he? Richard wouldn't be, you know, a king that would be lauded in Westminster particularly.
Very much so. So, I mean, Parliament is only really coming into a more recognisable shape later in the 13th century. John Maddicott has a book on this, talking about the development of the English Parliament. But no, I mean, famously, you know, Richard spends the most of his political career in France. Famously, of his 10 years as King of England, he spent about 6 months in England. So by no means is he kind of making great contributions to, you know, England's administrative constitutional development.
So just thinking about sort of going back towards where we started and Richard's commemoration and the fact, you know, the conversation we just had does suggest that some questions should be raised or could be raised about whether he is suitable to be commemorated in this way, given the conversations going on elsewhere. Why do you think that statues of medieval figures are seemingly outside of this conversation? Or are they? Maybe I've just missed it, but for me, I haven't seen too much conversation about them.
No, I haven't either. I think there are probably a number of factors that might help us to explain this. On the one hand, potentially the same kind of cultural dynamic that we've talked about in relation to the 19th century, this tendency to regard the Middle Ages as a kind of safe, simpler time, to associate it more with, you know, qualities like chivalry, moral values, rather than some of the more kind of complex issues that we've started to talk about. I think there's this wider issue that Geraldine Heng her work really might help us to kind of push through, namely this fact that pre-modern discrimination, racism in the Middle Ages, isn't seen in the same kind of continuum as subjects like slavery, colonialism, imperialism. Whereas if we're to have a conversation about the impact of these subjects like the Crusades, the treatment of Jews in the Middle Ages, we might be raising some of the very same issues that are kind of so vital in our own conversations about statues now, you know, statues of more modern figures involved in the slave trade and so on. But I think, yeah, on the whole, there's no real appetite among the public of any nation, as far as I can see, to start this task of bringing these, you know, these distant figures from the Middle Ages into a more modern discussion. Debating how far they still match up to, you know, the values and aspirations that we would like to think, you know, characterize our 21st century society.
So just specifically on that then, how far do you think that Richard I fulfills that test? How far does he map out to the values that we ascribe in the 21st century?
One just has to look at the contemporary responses to the execution of the of the Muslim prisoners at Acre to see, you know, this is a event that, you know, few people would really want to, you know, associate themselves with. This is an event that I don't think kind of matches up to the standards of behavior today. So there's the role that he plays in the Third Crusade. But to kind of take the 19th century iterations of Richard from the very start, Richard, despite the kind of incongruity and the fact that it kind of, you know, doesn't really map onto the 12th century reality, from the very start, Marochetti's statue is believed to embody an icon of Englishness, of English national identity. There's no kind of criticism on these grounds in the 19th century, But if we were to have a conversation about Richard in the 21st century, what we might well discuss is whether an icon of Englishness fully encapsulates the ideas, the values of all the peoples of Britain and Ireland who are represented at Westminster. So, I mean, to some degree, I see this question from the perspective of someone who isn't English. And I can see the case for arguing actually an icon of Englishness in the home of British democracy might not be all that in keeping with, you know, the ideas of everyone to whom that building is important today.
Yeah, no, that is a very interesting point. I just sort of summing up, I suppose, towards the end. Are there any other statues or medieval figures that would fall within the same sort of purview as this conversation we're having? I know there's a conversation going on in the States about the French King Louis IX and the statue in the city that is named after him, St. Louis. Where should we see that conversation go?
I really think that for the most part the statues of medieval figures really haven't become part of this conversation. The statue of Louis IX in Missouri is one. I think there was in June as in the aftermath of the events in Bristol and the removal of the Colston statue, there was one kind of stray incident where a statue of Robert the Bruce at Bannockburn was defaced. I don't think there have been any kind of real explanations about what was going on there as yet. But for the most part, no, I think the medieval figures have been, you know, left untouched, haven't become part of the conversation as far as I've seen. That's not to say that they won't. That's not to say that they shouldn't. It may well be that, you know, sooner rather than later, if we are to have a kind of wider cultural conversation about the importance, the continued relevance of these figures, it might well be that some of these medieval figures start to come under the microscope.
Fascinating. Dr. Simon John, thank you very much. That was a very interesting discussion. Are there any other points that we should have raised that you think are relevant? Any aspects that we haven't considered here?
I would just maybe end with what I would say is, it might start out as a kind of historical perspective and might sort of transmogrify along the way into a kind of call to arms, but we'll see anyway. What I would say is someone who's looked at the creation and kind of destruction of some statues in the 19th century is that from the very start, the act of creating a statue is a political, it's a symbolic act. And above all, it's designed to create a particular group identity among, you know, a particular set of people. It's designed to bring a group together. So in instances like those we're seeing recently, particular statues have caused controversy. The real debate behind this is the fact that these statues of past figures, they're evoking history in a way that kind of causes division in the present. And that division ultimately stems from the fact people have different interpretations of the past. What history would tell us is that, yeah, when such examples arise, when kind of controversial statues become part of a wider conversation, it's only right that the societies responsible for those statues have a conversation about, you know, do these artifacts still merit their status as cultural symbols? So if we come back to our kind of case study of Richard I, his statue at Parliament, I think it's only natural that we as a society might want to ask whether this 19th century statue of a 12th century figure kind of fully matches up to, you know, what we hold to be dear about our own 21st century society today. So that's all I'd say by kind of way of conclusion, perhaps kind of moving towards, as I say, a call to arms for kind of wider action.
Well, thank you very much. It's a very timely discussion, a very timely observation at the end there, and perhaps it will lead to some further conversations amongst medievalists or amongst the public at large. So, Dr. Simon John from Swansea University, thank you very much for your time. And I should mention you've written a book on Godfrey of Bouillon, and you're carrying out your statues project. Now, is that still ongoing, or have you sort of, is that you're in the thick of it right now?
In the thick of it, yeah. So now that the libraries are open here, I can, yeah, carry on with that project. So looking a bit more about the great exhibition, the display of Richard I, the first version of the Richard I statue there, as a kind of wider insight into, yeah, Victorian values and expectations.
That was Dr. Simon John talking to Dave Musgrove. You can find out more about the debate about statues on our website at historyextra.com. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back tomorrow when Louise Wilkinson will be speaking about Eleanor de Montfort,